culture to politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great day, we were told, when the President of the United States would author and introduce a dramatic new campaign to curb the upsurge in crime. Well, he's in the middle of laying that out, and it sounds very, very familiar. He's talking about banning assault weapons. That's going to suddenly make the nation better and safer. Let's go directly live to President Biden with his new crime program. Listen.
Enough rogue gun dealers feel like they can get away with selling guns to people who aren't legally allowed to own them. And I might add, the Second Amendment from the day it was passed limited the type of people who could own a gun and what type of weapon you could own. You couldn't buy a cannon. Those who say the blood of patriots, you know, and all the stuff about how we're going to have to move against the government. Well, the tree of liberty is not water with the blood of patriots. What's happened is that there are never been, if you wanted to think you need to have weapons to take on the government, you need F-15s and maybe some nuclear weapons. The point is that there's always been the ability to rationally limit the type of weapon that can be owned and who can own it. The last time we had data on this issue of who was purchasing guns was more than 20 years ago. 5% of gun dealers, turns out, in the study we did, showed that 90% of illegal guns were found at the crime scenes sold by 5% of gun dealers. 5% sold 90% of the guns found at crime scenes. And these merchants of death are breaking the law for profit. They're selling guns that are killing innocent people. It's wrong. It's unacceptable. As the Attorney General said, we're going to crack down on those gun dealers and the violent criminals they knowingly arm. In April, I announced that the Justice Department is going to be issuing an annual report on gun trafficking so we can update that data. Today, the department is announcing, as I just did, a major crackdown on stem the flow of guns used to commit violent crimes. It's zero tolerance for gun dealers who willfully violate key existing laws and regulations. Let me repeat, zero tolerance. If you willfully sell a gun to someone who's prohibited from possessing it, if you willfully fail to run a background check, if you willfully falsify a record, if you willfully fail to cooperate with the tracing request or inspections, my message to you is this: we'll find you, and we will seek your license to sell guns. We'll make sure you can't sell death and mayhem on our streets. It's an outrage. It has to end, and we'll end it, period. Second, we discussed disrupting illegal gun trafficking. Now, the gun lobby wants you to believe that cities that are the toughest gun, had the toughest gun laws, still have the highest rates of gun violence. As was pointed out by the group we had today in our roundtable, the violence is so, they argue, why do you need those gun laws if they don't work in cities that have tough laws? Don't believe it. Here's the truth. Today's conversation with Mayor Scott of Baltimore, for example, echoed what we know to be the case and hear from mayors all across the country. Mayors have the power to help shape and enforce the laws in their cities, but they can't control the laws in neighboring cities and states, even though the gun legally bought there is often ends up in their streets. Mayor Scott says that 80% of the guns in Baltimore were acquired outside the city. Outside the city. There's little he can do about that. So we have to act. As part of our strategy, the Justice Department is creating 5 new strike forces to crack down illegal gun trafficking and the carters supplying weapons to cities like New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., and the Bay Area. With these strike forces, local and federal law enforcement and prosecutors are going to be able to better coordinate the prosecution of illegal gun trafficking across city and state lines. So, illegal guns sold from the back door of a gun shop in Virginia don't end up in a murder scene in Baltimore. And if they do, then local and federal law enforcement can better coordinate to trace illegal gun sales back to a shady gun dealer and hold them accountable.
Okay, President Biden is continuing with his emphasis, and I guess this is predictable. I find it very disappointing the emphasis being on the flow of guns. And when there's so many other things that are worthy of attention. And the point that he was making about people saying that, well, if gun control, more gun control is the answer, why is it that the most dangerous cities in America, the ones that are most crime-ridden, like Chicago, like Baltimore, like St. Louis, he mentioned the mayor of Baltimore, Mayor Scott, part of the proof here is that they already have very tough gun laws. The problems are that, number one, they don't have enough law enforcement resources to enforce those gun laws. President Biden says, Baldy, we're going to stop it. We're going to put an end to it. How do you do that without law enforcement personnel? And this at a time when police are facing cutbacks almost everywhere, and in some places in a crazy way. And he is saying that we're going to target these illegal gun dealers. I think fine. If people are knowingly breaking the law and selling guns to provide and arm gangs, by all means, they should face very serious consequences, by imprisonment, loss of a license, no ability to continue to do that. But wouldn't it make more sense to focus on gangs? One of the things we know is that a great many of the deaths, certainly in cities like Chicago, it's almost all gang-involved shootings. So what we really need is something that requires a great deal of resources and a great deal of human personnel, which is to go after these gangs. And the point is that President Biden says, we know that banning assault weapons works. It works. It doesn't work. And again, it's been proven and even acknowledged by people who published, who sponsored the initial gun weapons ban. At the beginning of the Clinton administration, I think it was 1994, they passed this new sweeping anti-crime bill, and part of it was a ban on assault weapons, but it was only supposed to last for 10 years. And then after that, they were going to analyze its impact, and then analyze the impact of when they returned to the sale of so-called assault weapons. And it didn't make any difference. Did crime go down? Did mass shootings go down while the assault weapon ban was there? Yes, but it didn't go up after it was removed. It was part of a general reduction in a crime, which was part of that Get Tough on Crime bill that Joe Biden used to be proud of co-sponsoring. He's clearly not comfortable with this issue. And is that because of the defund the police radicals? Speaking of defund the police radicals, an amazing story out of Portland where it's extraordinary. It's an Associated Press story. It's not a conservative-based story. Police in Oregon's largest city are being advised to no longer pursue low-level traffic infractions. Why? Because the people who are investigated on low-level traffic infractions are disproportionately people of color. And this coming at a time when $27 million was slashed from the police budget last year. $11 million due to the pandemic-caused budget crisis and $15 million amid calls to defund the police. Rather than simply targeting gun dealers, shouldn't we be targeting gangs and the proliferation of gang culture and offering support for policing that we know that works? What is called broken windows policing. All of the material written about the crime reduction in New York City gives Giuliani credit for that kind of law enforcement reform. What kind of law enforcement reform or reform generally doesn't work? Handing people free money without preconditions, investigation, or any follow-up. Just sending checks in the mail. Why doesn't that work? We'll talk to the former head of social services for the city of New York. Coming up on the Michael Medved Show. On the Michael Medved Medved Show. Very glad to welcome to the program Robert Doerr, who is the president of the American Enterprise Institute, one of Washington's most important conservative think tanks. He is also a former commissioner in New York City of social services. He served under Mayor Bloomberg back in 2007 to 2013. He's written an important piece in Wall Street Journal under the headline, Free Money Can Make Life Worse. Commissioner Doerr, great to speak to you.
Thanks for having me on, Michael.
What a great pleasure. Okay, you make a tremendously important point. With everything else going on, there's a disaster about to happen that actually looks like a gift, but it's a disaster. And the disaster is the government sending out checks apparently starting in September. Sooner than that,
starting in July, the IRS is becoming America's biggest welfare agency and has decided to sort of take over for state and local governments that normally give out cash assistance to people in need. And when they normally do it under the provisions of welfare policy since Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich reform welfare, a person would need to come into an office or see someone and get an evaluation of their situation. And I know it sounds like hassle and sounds like casework, but it actually helps people recognize that their problem isn't just their absence of money. It's also, it might have something to do with the absence of another parent. It might have something to do with a substance abuse issue. It might mainly have to do with the fact that they don't have a job. And in that human interaction that we have in states and counties and cities all across America, there is an effort to get someone to help move forward. That's being replaced in part by this new initiative that was sort of passed under the cover of the COVID emergency bills that is going to send a check monthly to families who aren't working and not making necessarily any attempt to work. And it's going to come every month, and it's going to be a new sort of government benefit to people with children in the household. It will, I don't think, necessarily help them in the ways that they really need to be helped. And it may prevent them from seeking the help that would help them get their lives in order and help them move forward and be better parents, better citizens, better workers, better spouses. And I know it sounds like I'm sort of celebrating casework and caseworkers, but the fact is, and it's not all government, there's not-for-profit and faith-based institutions that are involved in this work, a human interaction between a person who's trying to provide help and a person in need of help is a positive thing, and that's being replaced in this new sort of check writing from the IRS. I mean, people will receive a check.
And it's just, it's an unconditional check. The one thing that leaps to mind for me is there's been a lot of discussion about right now the labor shortage in the United States. There are all kinds of unfilled jobs, literally millions of them, millions and millions of unfilled jobs right now. And a lot of the blame has gone to the $300 a month in additional unemployment benefits. Now, right now, what you're talking about is a program where you get $300 per child, whether you're working or not. Isn't that going to have an even more destructive impact on the employment market?
Well, yes, although not everybody has a child. So there are a lot of people that are getting benefits from the unemployment system, and there's also a lot of people with children. So they're both bad, in my view, is that if you give people money that allows them to stay out of the labor market, they will stay out of the labor market. And frankly, I don't think that's actually in their best interest, because being in work allows you to move up. It allows you to interact with people in your community. You're much more likely to be healthy. But yes, this is a continuation of the Democrats' view that the way you help people is transfer government money to them, versus which, honestly, most Republicans or people on the right view is the way you help people is you help them get a job. And, there's a conflict there. And Democrats don't like to admit that their method of helping Americans is transfer payments, but it's true. That's what they do when they're in power. And it dampens the labor market, it reduces the supply of labor, and it keeps people out of the labor market. And it may be easier and more comfortable for some people, but it's actually not healthier for them, their children, their community, and the country.
One of the things that people bring up all the time on the left is that America has a disproportionate number of people who are poor, who are children, or young children. What should be done about that?
Well, my view in that case is that it's always been true. There's a combination of ways in which you do that. That's what I used to do. I was the commissioner of social services in New York City. We reduced child poverty in New York City when I was commissioner. And the way you do that is usually people who are in poverty in households with children is because there's less employment. There's less earning. If we can get people into work, they're far less likely to be poor. And then we can support that work, because sometimes that work isn't enough, with various other forms of benefits that make work pay. And we do that a lot in the United States, and it significantly reduces child poverty. But the key is both. You need both employment and assistance, but you can't diminish or replace or undermine employment by giving people assistance without any conditions, without any contact, without any encouragement to get into employment. If people stay out of work and receive these benefits, my view is they're going to remain poor.
So many people on the left regularly talk about how we have to learn from the Scandinavian countries, from Norway, Denmark, Sweden, Finland. And don't they have some social work component? They don't just send checks in the mail, right?
That is correct. The misinterpretation of what really happens in those countries is very, very rampant. And they're entirely different countries. They're smaller populations. They're less diverse. And they're much smaller. The thing that we have here that's being missed is that we have states and cities that have normally been responsible for this interaction with people that helps them move up. I honestly believe it does help them move up when it's done correctly. Now, all of a sudden, we're replacing that with checks from Washington. And I think that has nothing to do with what they're doing in Scandinavia. And it is not, I think, in the long-term best interest of the United States.
That's Robert Doerr. He is president of the American Enterprise Institute, succeeding our good friend Arthur Brooks, by the way. He served as New York City's Commissioner of Social Services for 6 years. And I'm sure has written about that and has a lot to say in terms of shaping better social services for the nation at large. When we come back, talking about better social services, some indications of voices in the media where you wouldn't expect them, talking some sense about everything, including even critical race theory. That and much more coming up on The Medved Show.
God help me, I'm addicted to
The Michael Medved Show.
Show, just a reminder for folks to sign up. Many of you already have for the program at the Reagan Library on July 14th. It's next month. We're full moon right now. July 14th, we're talking about 3 weeks from now. And in fact, it'll be 3 weeks less a day because it'll be on a Wednesday. Speaking at the Reagan Library in the evening about God's hand on America. A concept which I am very eager to defend at this controversial time when people think there's something diabolical about America. And we'll also be broadcasting live from noon to 3 in Simi Valley, California. Join us at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library. It's completely free. Go to michaelmedved.com, click on the banner, and you can sign up for your participation and see the magnificent Reagan Library at the same time. Actually makes you feel better about the country just to think about what President Reagan went through and achieved. Speaking of that, there's not a lot of good feeling out there in the country right now. There should be. I mean, we're coming through this pandemic, but in Loudoun County, Virginia, there was a school board meeting last night, and it didn't go well. The school board was supposed to be discussing two things. They were discussing a policy about gender fluidity and about transgender students, and they were also going to be discussing some controversies about critical race theory and what was going on in that regard. The Virginia parents in Loudoun County were confronting the school board about critical race theory, and here's basically some of what the parents, there are 300 of them, who showed up at the school board meeting, which normally gets a dozen. And here's what some of the angry parents of every race, by the way, had to say. Clip 12.
I never thought I'd see the day when I'd have to stand up to protect my kids from their own school board. You put the feelings of a few above the safety and discomfort of the entire rest of the student body, and that is completely unacceptable.
It is not political. It is parental, and I absolutely refuse to co-parent with LCPS.
Why is only a one-way narrative allowed to take place under your watch? Why is religious freedom being ignored and trampled upon under your watch?
CRT, like its counterpart, the 1619 Project, is nothing but phony scholarship. It isn't meant to achieve anything. It's meant to divide and destroy this country by people who hate it.
They caught you red-handed with an enemies list to punish opponents of critical race theory. You're teaching children to hate others because of their skin color.
Okay, and then there was, after the fiery speech by a parent, there was an arrest, there was an attempt to adjourn the meeting, and then it ended up sounding like this. This is clip three.
This board has a dark history of suppressing free speech. They caught you red-handed with an enemies list to punish opponents of critical race theory. You're teaching children to hate others because of their skin color, and you're forcing them to lie about other kids' gender. I am disgusted by your bigotry and your depravity.
Joe Mobley to be followed by Donna Russell. Madam Chair, I move to end public comment. There's been a motion to end public comment. Is there a second? I second. Motion made by Ms. Reeser and seconded by Ms. King. Is there any discussion? All in favor, please raise your hand and say aye.
Aye.
Ms. Corbo, can I record your vote, please?
Aye.
Thank you. The motion carries 9-0. Public comment is now ended. We will move to our next agenda item.
This is a tough meeting. They were chanting shame on you, and it sounded like this. This is a clip of five. Okay, these are parents mostly with kids in this school district, and not all education stories right now are alarming. There's this, Republican Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida signed a bill yesterday requiring high school students to learn about the evils of communism and totalitarianism. During a press conference at Three Oaks Middle School in Fort Myers, DeSantis signed three education bills designed to foster civic literacy, that's the phrase, in schools. quote, it's crucial to ensure that we teach our students how to be responsible citizens. This is what Governor DeSantis talked about in that bill signing in Florida. This is clip two.
The bill also expands our previous efforts in civics to add a requirement for the high school government class that students receive instruction on the evils of communism and totalitarian ideologies. We have a number of people in Florida, particularly Southern Florida, who've escaped totalitarian regimes, who've escaped communist dictatorships, to be able to come to America. We want all students to understand the difference. Why would somebody flee across shark-infested waters, say, leaving from Cuba to come to Southern Florida? Why would somebody leave a place like Vietnam? Why would people leave these countries and risk their life to be able to come here? It's important that students understand that. Now, as part of this bill, Florida will create a Portraits and Patriotism Library so students can learn about real patriots who came to this country after seeing the horrors of these communist regimes.
Okay, you don't think that Ron DeSantis is going to run a serious race for president? By the way, another politician on the other side of things is India Walton. She's a Democrat. And she's also a self-described socialist. Yesterday, she appeared to be headed toward a win and a January inauguration as the 63rd mayor of Buffalo. She's the first woman and the first avowed socialist to be chosen as mayor of Buffalo. I think about that because, you know, who used to represent Buffalo in the House of Representatives of the United States for many years? Ran for president. He was Secretary of Housing and Urban Development under President Reagan. Jack Kemp, football star, football Hall of Famer, I believe. Jack Kemp, star of the San Diego Chargers and the Buffalo Bills, and a great American patriot who definitely would not have endorsed socialism. I mean, Buffalo's had some issues, and what they need right now is a socialist approach. Look, the idea of teaching about communism and totalitarianism and the number of people who died in that process, just as I think it's necessary for people to learn about the horrors of slavery, and it is essential that people know about that, that slavery was not a benign institution, it was a profoundly evil institution, just as I believe it is necessary for people to have learned about the bloody record of the Holocaust, it is also essential for people to know about the estimated 70 million people who were killed by Mao, by the Chinese communists, and at least 25 million people who were killed by the Stalin regime in Russia. There is, in fact, a book compiled by French scholars from the left called Communism's Black Book, which talks about 100 million dead bodies. Yes, our kids should know about that. And there's more. They should know about part of what our police do for us. We'll get to that coming up on the MedVet Show. And on the Michael MedVet Show, there was a big Supreme Court decision, another one today, and one that actually I think most liberals and conservatives can agree was rightly adjudicated. This was the case of the impolite, outrageous, in-your-face cheerleader. Okay, the story is Brandy Levy, who is now an 18-year-old college student, was passed over for the varsity cheerleading squad at Mahonoy Area High School. And that's in Pennsylvania. And on a spring Saturday in her freshman year in high school, she posted on Snapchat a photo of herself with a friend. And they both had upraised their middle fingers. And then they posted on Snapchat along with the following eloquent message, F school, F softball, F cheer, meaning cheerleading, F everything. It was sent out to about 250 friends, including fellow cheerleaders in her school. It was supposed to disappear in 24 hours, but her cheerleading coaches were alerted to it, and Levy was suspended from cheerleading for a year, but not from school. And she sued. And it was battled its way right up to the Supreme Court. An appeals court had said that schools had no authority over student speech that occurs off campus. But in an 8-1 decision, Clarence Thomas was a lone dissenter. Stephen Breyer, who the Democrats are trying to push off the court, he's 82. And Stephen Breyer, they want him to resign before the Biden's term is over. And frankly, before the Democrats lose control of the Senate, which would make it much tougher to get somebody confirmed. In any event, Breyer wrote that he would not agree with the appeals court that said that school had no authority of student speech that occurs off campus. He wrote, we do not now set forth a broad, highly general First Amendment rule stating that what counts as off-campus speech and whether or how ordinary First Amendment standards must give way off campus to a school's special need to prevent substantial disruption of learning-related activities or the protection of those who make up a school community. By the way, that sentence I just read you, which is about 7 lines long, is one of the reasons that Stephen Breyer is not generally considered one of the most persuasive or elegant writers on the Supreme Court. Sorry, Mr. Justice. Breyer wrote, the vulgarity in BL's posts, he referred to her throughout, not as Brandy Levy, which is her name, but as BL. The vulgarity in BL's posts encompassed a message, an expression of BL's irritation with and criticism of the school and cheerleading communities. Well, no blank, Sherlock. I mean, that's obvious. He added, the school's interest in teaching good manners is not sufficient in this case to overcome BL's interest in free expression. In other words, what the court has been holding ever since a case some years ago that set the parameters, a case of Mary Beth Tinker, which was decided in a 7-2 basis, they've been holding that if an action or a position or an expression will disrupt the learning environment in a serious way, then the school has a right to take some consequences and take some measures to prevent that kind of disruptive speech, even if it's off campus. But that was not this. And I think that most people can agree with that. Simply because somebody says those nasty words about on Snapchat, where, of course, nobody else ever uses nasty terminology, because somebody has something rude to say on Snapchat, that means that an educational process is going to be significantly disrupted. So this is being viewed by the American Civil Liberties Union as a grand expression of free speech and a great victory for free speech. It's not that, but it does indicate a strong, almost unanimous majority. It's 8-1 on the Supreme Court. Triumph for Justice Roberts, for Chief Justice Roberts, and triumph, it seems to me, for a reasonable point of view. There's also at least a hint of a reasonable point of view that turned up on CNN, of all places, after a ride-along with the NYPD for 48 hours. When I did a series of ride-alongs many, many years ago, and we're talking about in the 1970s, right along with the Oakland and Berkeley police departments in the Bay Area for whom I was doing some work, it changed my life because you see the world from a cop's point of view. Maybe it had that impact on CNN. Listen, this is clip 10A.
Shooting incidents in New York City this May were up 73% compared to the same period last year, according to the NYPD. In the 4-6, these officers find many of the shooters and victims are still in their teens.
And it sucks to see this, to see 16-year-old kids shooting and killing each other. And that's what we do see a lot of here. And we have 16-year-olds with robbery patterns and murder charges, and it's like they didn't actually get to be kids.
A radio call brings word of a hit-and-run driver. We arrive to find the victim on the ground and bleeding. Ask police officers and their commanders why crime is rising, and they describe a mix of factors. The end of the pandemic has brought residents out of their homes. Guns have flooded these communities. The jump in New York City has also coincided with changes to policing and the justice system. New York enacted bail reform to reduce or eliminate jail time for suspects while awaiting trial for many misdemeanors and nonviolent felonies. Police say this has had the unintended consequence of putting repeat offenders back on the street.
Okay, that's it. I mean, if you talk to people like even Eric Adams, who is the apparent winner, or at least the clear front runner for mayor of New York with their crazy ranked voting system, that's bail reform and letting people out on bail or without bail has been a very real factor. And then just a word quickly that that the fact is that there's also undermining of the police that has had a very real impact on the crime rate. More from that CNN ride-along.
We've had people threaten us, to kill us, threaten to
kill our families.
Kill our family. I hope your family dies. I hope your family gets raped. You know, like stuff like that that we're supposed to brush off.
This environment is having a debilitating effect on the rank and file.
The NYPD is shedding officers faster than it can recruit new ones, some retiring early, some outright leaving the force. It's partly a morale problem. That's what the officers tell us. And the fact that it's happening as crime is rising is affecting operations.
The NYPD has had its own failures. The 2014 death of Eric Garner during an arrest in which an officer used a chokehold did not result in charges, but still resonates here. NYPD Commissioner Dermot Shea, who repeatedly condemned George Floyd's killing, says departments have the responsibility to police their own aggressively.
We have over 6 million calls for service a year. We may have negative encounters where we have to arrest people without force being used, but hundreds of thousands of times a year. Jim, one bad incident and can set you back so far. And you see that across the country.
As New York and other cities simultaneously grapple with the aftermath of George Floyd's killing and the rise in crime, police are now debating a whole range of police policies and tactics.
And some of those tactics put forward by President Biden today, we will get to a point-by-point response to what seemed to be a fairly feeble presentation of a new crime initiative, which is very much needed. There's also this about Portland, where they are not going to be authorizing police unless there is an immediate and imminent danger to the public to stopping people for minor traffic offenses. Gun violence in Portland has spilled over into this year with at least 42 homicides so far. If nothing changes, Portland will surpass its all-time record for homicides of 70 set in 1987. Not the kind of record you want to set. Next time on the Medved Show, a dispute over a menu for a Juneteenth special at IKEA. What was on the menu? We will get to that and two hard truths about race in America with Charles Murray and this greatest nation on God's green earth.
The old way of living with diabetes is a pain. You've got